Thanks, Ted. All right. Thanks for having me. And it's a pleasure to be here. And it's a pleasure to be in a physics department that's so broad, encompassing really the full spectrum of physics. Few physics departments do these days. So it's fun. So I'll talk about giant planet atmospheres. And in the exuberance of writing the abstract, I wrote a lot more than I can actually cover. I focus mainly on our giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and I'll talk a little bit about implications for other giant planets, but I focus on the ones that we can say most about. And this is joint work, primarily with Junjun Liu. So here's Jupiter, as seen from Cassini. This is just a couple images stitched together, and it runs through a loop, and you see a number of familiar features. There's a great red spot, and you see these cloud bands. And in particular, you see that the clouds here move to the right near the equator. It's prograde flow. It's a little harder to see. There's retrograde flow right here, up there. And you have this alternating sequence of jets, prograde and retrograde on Jupiter, that ultimately gives rise to the colored bands and the like. So you see this is the actual velocity profile that you get from tracking these clouds. It's a strong prograde jet at the equator, order 100 meters per second winds. Then you have these relatively strong off-equatorial jets that still prograde, and then the sequence of weaker retrograde prograde jets that alternate. And of course, one of the oldest questions about Jupiter is how does its flow pattern come about? How does it give rise to the banded structure of Jupiter? So this is the zonal wind. Now, a bit more quantitatively, it's the same curve that was overlaid on the animation before. One of the curves is from Cassini measurements. The other curve is from Voyager measurements a few decades before. Point is, they're pretty similar. The winds haven't changed very much, except this jet has changed a little bit over the decades. These are very robust flow features that seem to be stable in time. And there are a couple things that are interesting about this flow pattern. The one is that there's what's called equatorial superrotation. You have prograde flow at the equator. That means that there's a local maximum in the absolute angular momentum, the angular momentum in an inertial frame at the equator. And that's curious because it can't easily happen, as I'll explain. The scale of this jet, it goes to about 12 degrees or so, north or south, and that's something we'll come back to. And then you have these extratropical jets, they're spaced at about 8 degrees apart. By the way, the zero wind line here, so Jupiter is a gas planet, the zero wind line is all measured relative to the rotation of the magnetic field. If you put together similar pictures for all our solar system giant planets, and all these pictures come from tracking clouds, and in the old days, grad students were sitting there and transcribing how they were moving and translating that into velocity, now use feature tracking algorithms to put together a velocity profile, and this is what you get. So on the left is Jupiter we had, then the next one is Saturn. Numbers to keep in mind, the velocity at the equator is about 100 meters per second or so. Saturn, there are a couple curves, and they correspond to curves taking a different wavelength with different kinds of instruments. There are ground-based observations. There are observations from the Hubble Space Telescope. And as you see, away from the equator, they tend to coincide relatively well to the degree that there are multiple observations. Likewise, these jets are pretty stable. Right near the equator, it depends on which wavelengths you look, you seem to be getting slightly different flow velocities. And this could indicate variations, temporal variations. They're not all simultaneous observations, or this could indicate vertical variations of the flow. And I think it's the latter, it's vertical variations, and I'll come back to that. And then Uranus and Neptune are kind of curious. They look very different. The observations are much sparser, but there is retrograde flow at the equator, and quite strong, both on Uranus and Neptune, even stronger, 400 meters per second. And there seems to be only one jet off the equator for each one of those. Sometimes, you know, these results are made into a paradox of the sort that, well, obviously, you move away from the sun, the solar constant is smallest for Neptune, yet the winds are strongest. I think it's a very misleading way of putting that. The strength of insulation doesn't have really anything directly to do with the strength of the winds, but it is a peculiar thing that there are so strong winds in a solar system that far out. So I want to address how the structure of these winds comes about, and how these differences come about. Why do Jupiter and Saturn have prograde jets here, have several off-equatorial jets, and Uranus and Neptune, why do they look so different, and particularly have a retrograde flow at the equator? And saying the super rotation for Jupiter and Saturn, sub rotation for Uranus and Neptune. Why is that? That's the first question to address. And on the surface, this is pretty surprising because, in an order of magnitude sense, these planets are not that different. Radii, rotation rates, they differ, but in order of magnitude, they're pretty similar. The way these planets differ from each other is in the energy budget. And all of them emit slightly more radiation than they receive from the sun. And that means they have an internal heat source, so they're still not in equilibrium, they're gravitationally contracting, and primarily the leftover energy from the gravitational contraction comes out as heat and is an internal heat source for these planets. So you have some, if you think about the upper atmosphere of those planets, there's some heat coming from below, which probably comes out there fairly uniformly. There's no evidence or no theoretical reason to expect strong gradients between the equator and the pole in these heat fluxes. They're small gradients, but not very large gradients. And then, of course, they receive sunlight from the top, and there are gradients in insulation between the equator and the pole. For Jupiter, in particular, has a very small obliquity, so it's basically a cosine function in insulation at the top. And the total amount of radiation, for example, Jupiter absorbs from the sun, it's about 8 watts per meter squared. The internal heat flux is of the same order of magnitude, about 6 watts per meter squared. The total is about 40 watts per meter squared of energy that you have to drive the flow. Saturn, it's similar, less solar constant, obviously smaller. The internal heat flux is somewhat weaker, but in relative terms, there's a little bit more insulation than internal heat flux, but they're quite similar. Uranus has very weak intrinsic heat fluxes. They're consistent with zero within measurement uncertainties. But Neptune has a stronger intrinsic heat flux than what Neptune receives as insulation. That is one key difference between these planets. But from that difference alone, that doesn't tell you immediately why the flows look so different. So I'd like to explain why the flows are so different and like to get at the fundamental principles behind it. And these principles, they're fundamental. They should be good for any planet in our solar system or elsewhere. And this is a physics department. The only thing you really have to appreciate is Newton's second law here. There really isn't much else to it, but it gets sufficiently complicated to think about that in a rotating system and in a continuous medium. So one observational balance in Newton's second law or in the angular momentum balance here for Jupiter is this. The upper panel shows, this is from a paper by Salik. The upper panel shows the zonal wind, the same flow profile I showed before, just now with the latitude axis in the horizontal and the vertical axis being the zonal wind axis. And then I just drew some blue lines through some of the maxima in the zonal wind. And the lower panel shows what I want you to focus on is primarily the right axis here. It says U prime, V prime. This is the turbulent flux of angular momentum. It's proportional to the turbulent flux of angular momentum. So it represents the angular momentum around the spin axis that is transported by the turbulent eddies. And these are these dots with the arrow bars on them. And the point to note is that this is a flux. So if you take the derivative in the meridional direction and latitude direction, you get the divergence of that flux. And the point that you can see is that these fluxes, they tend to converge pretty much. So this flux here is northward, here it's southward. So you have convergence right at the blue line where there is a maximum in this zonal wind. And you can just go through all these peaks. So here it's positive, it's northward flux, there's southward flux of angular momentum. You have convergence of angular momentum into that peak, into the next peak, and that's true for all of these peaks. So the observation is that angular momentum is transported into prograde jets, out of retrograde jets, by the turbulent motion. That's very generally so, and that's observed in Jupiter. That's true for Earth atmosphere as well. It's basically true for any rapidly rotating atmosphere that turbulence has that property, that it transports angular momentum out of retrograde into prograde jets. And what that means is, of course, that there's a transfer of kinetic energy from the turbulent field to the mean flow. So the turbulence imparts kinetic energy to the mean flow. And you can take these angular momentum fluxes and calculate the kinetic energy transfer they imply. So that you get from the correlation with the mean flow and these turbulent angular momentum fluxes. The result is that the angular momentum transfer corresponds to about 10 to the minus 5 watts per cubic meter in the upper troposphere. So all that comes from tracking clouds. These clouds live in the upper troposphere. It's all we can really see. And what we know is per cubic meter, per volume, we have about 10 to the minus 5 watts of energy transfer from turbulence to the mean fields. Now, we don't know how deep this turbulent kinetic energy transfer extends in the atmosphere. We can't see. We can only see the tops of the clouds. But we know that Jupiter has order 10 watts per meter squared in energy available to drive the flow. It has a finite Carnot efficiency as a heat engine. The atmosphere has a finite efficiency in converting that energy into kinetic energy that eventually must be dissipated. So order 1 watt per meter squared or less is probably at most what the energy that can be dissipated on Jupiter. So if you have 10 to the minus 5 watts per meter squared, if this transfer extends over 10 kilometers depth, you already are at 10 to the minus 1 watt per meter squared in energy transfer from eddies to the mean flow. The immediate consequence here is very important for, I think, really decades of literature in this field. These data have been around for a while, but haven't really been put together in this form. These angular momentum fluxes can't extend very deeply into the atmosphere. If they would, they would transfer way more kinetic energy to the mean flow than is available to drive the mean flow in the first place. That's not possible. So the observations and basic thinking about energy balance and momentum balance tell you that the angular momentum fluxes, at least, that we see, they can't go very deep into the atmosphere. Order tens of kilometers, maybe, but not very much more. So that's an immediate problem for one class of models that are around for the giant planets. These are come from the dynamo literature. These are Rayleigh-Baynard convection models, going back to work by Busse and others in the 70s. And the idea here is that you have rapid rotation, convection in a rapidly rotating spherical shell. And if it's rapidly rotating, this convection will organize itself along cylinders parallel with the spin axis. And what you see at the top, the clouds, are just sections through these cylinders. They can alternate in direction of rotation. And what you see is just sort of the surface manifestation of these rotating cylinders. The problem is, how deep should they go? The usual models assume they go to depths of 10 to the 7, 10 to the 6 kilometers. And it doesn't really matter if you favor 10 to the 5. The point is they go way deeper than 10 kilometers. And in these models, these angular momentum fluxes per unit volume, they're roughly constant along cylinders, which they have to be, and that has to do with the fact that these flows are essentially barotropic, we call them. There are no entropy gradients in the interior. So the idea for those models is the energy comes from the interior, drives the flow. Insulation basically doesn't matter. It tends to be completely ignored in those models. And then you get these cylindrical flows. But the observations tell you that if you get the upper tropospheric angular momentum fluxes right in those models, and they roughly do, but then they go so deep, 10 to the 6 kilometers or something, the kinetic energy transfer from mean flow from the eddy to the mean flows is a factor of a million or so too large. Whether it's 10 to 5 or 10 to 8, again, doesn't matter. It's way wrong. The models, they reproduce flows that make pictures that they look good, but I think very fundamentally they can't be right. You have this energy transfer that is much too big. As a result, you have much too high dissipation. To balance the dissipation, you need much too high energy sources. And people working with those models know that. They know that they have to overforce them vastly. The usual argument is, there might be some similarity argument you can make to get to the relevant energies. My point here is there's no similarity argument you can make to get to the right energies because the angular momentum balance tells you it's not possible with these cylindrical flows. If you get the right energy balance, your upper tropospheric flows won't be right anymore. They'll have too small structures, typically. Let me not dwell on that. It's just one example of kinds of flows you get in those models, and I think the kind of problem they have and the very fundamental problem they have. Now, there are about $2 billion on the way to Jupiter right now. The Juno mission was launched a few months ago. It will arrive in Jupiter in 2016, and Juno, the spacecraft, the goal is to measure the composition and the temperature structure of Jupiter below the clouds. So far, almost all we know comes from cloud level and above, with one exception: a Galileo probe entered Jupiter in low latitudes and got one profile there. But the composition will affect both the gravity signals that Juno will measure, it'll affect the microwave signals Juno will measure, and the temperature structure will affect those as well. So one goal for us here was to provide some information of what dynamics alone tells you about ultimately the gravity microwave measurements that Juno will see, assuming the composition is uniform, so that you can disentangle compositional and dynamical effects in the end. The kinds of deep models that are around, of which I just showed you an example, they, I think, ultimately can't provide that information. They won't get the right vertical structure. They just assume an isentropic interior from the outset, and energetically, this can't work out. So we had to go back to thinking about fairly basics and try to put together how these planets work from ultimately first principles. And let me, in the interest of time, not dwell on this, let me just say, the first insight from atmospheric dynamics here, it goes back to work by Haidt in the 60s, is that there cannot be any interior extremum of angular momentum, of absolute angular momentum, the angular momentum in an inertial system, in a two-dimensional fluid, in a fluid that's symmetric around the spin axis of the planet. For that to happen, to have any extremum of angular momentum, what you need to have are turbulent angular momentum fluxes that bring angular momentum into that extremum. And the implication is that, as we have seen in observations, these turbulent fluxes that bring angular momentum toward the equator on Jupiter and Saturn, there are similar observations for Saturn, I just showed you those for Jupiter, they must exist for the superrotation to exist at the equator. At the equator, it means there's an angular momentum maximum, a local maximum, and there must be turbulent fluxes. And so the first question is, how does the superrotation come about? And Haidt's theorem tells you there must be angular momentum fluxes into the equatorial region for superrotation to arise. And that's the first fundamental insight, and it really comes from fairly straightforward arguments from angular momentum conservation. Nothing very unusual going into that. And the second insight that's important for what I need here is that in any rapidly rotating atmosphere, you get angular momentum fluxes in any rapidly rotating atmosphere. Generally, the angular momentum flux is going in the opposite direction of the group velocity of waves, Rossby waves in particular. And that's not just a statement about linear waves, it's a fairly general statement about mixing properties of the turbulence. So more generally, the angular momentum fluxes are directed from regions of wave dissipation into regions of wave generation. So if you want to get the first thing right about Jupiter and Saturn, which is this very prominent equatorial jet, you have to answer what is a wave source in the equatorial region. Once you find some way of generating waves in the equatorial region, then they'll bring angular momentum there and they can spin up a jet. And so the first question to answer is, what is that wave source? How can you get it? And how can you get it in a way that doesn't violate the energetics that we have observed on those planets? And my work on this started with one nice observation from Andy Ingersoll and Hiro Kanamori. The comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 fell into Jupiter, and it created waves. And you couldn't measure the wave speed of these waves, and they were interpreted as gravity waves. And the wave speed of those waves was 450 meters per second. And as often, these observations are not completely unambiguous. It's not completely clear these are gravity waves. But if you accept these are gravity waves, you have a gravity wave speed. And from the gravity wave speed and the geometry rotation rate of a planet, you can calculate a number of characteristic scales. There is one scale, it's the mid-latitude Rossby radius. It's the scale of the most unstable rotational waves away from the equator. It's about 2,000 kilometers. And the scale of waves near the equator, the preferential, the largest scale of waves at the equator that would be generated, you can also calculate from the gravity wave speed, and F and beta, F is Coriolis parameter, beta its gradient, so it's just the rotation rate of the planet entering here essentially. It turns out to be 10,000 kilometers or corresponding to about 8 degrees latitude. And my work here started with noting that this is fairly close to the scale of this equatorial jet, and this is fairly close to the scale of the jets away from the equator. So it's not just Newton's second law, but also the law of thermodynamics we need, but in a simple form. And this is it, so this is the only, I think it's about the only equation, but let me just state what it is. The thermodynamic balance you can write in this form, so the B, you can think of as buoyancy or entropy, has a time derivative, there's an advection term, and there is a vertical advection term, n squared is the buoyancy frequency squared, so it's a the vertical entropy stratification. The right-hand side is some sort of heating. And the question we want to answer here is how do you generate waves in the equatorial region? And there's something special about the equatorial region, and that's why you and or many of us go on vacation in the tropics. Temperature gradients are weak, and temperature fluctuations are weak. And that's a fairly fundamental property of low-latitude regions having to do with the force balance there. So these two terms tend to be very small compared to this term, and that's balanced by heating. So it's saying near the equator, heating is balanced by vertical motion. Then you use the continuity equation, just write divide by n squared and take the vertical derivative, use continuity, you have a horizontal divergence. It's saying that the horizontal divergence is related to heating, or the vertical derivative of heating divided by the buoyancy frequency, or you can generate fluctuations in horizontal divergence through fluctuations in heating, in particular, taking n squared as something given. So in particular, what I like to think about is you have intrinsic heat fluxes coming from the interior. They lead to convection. Convection leads to fluctuations, clouds, convective plumes that have been observed on Jupiter. And these convective heating fluctuations are associated with a divergence fluctuation. And the divergence fluctuation, this is Newton's second law, maybe not in a form that's familiar to everyone, but it is. Zeta is vorticity. This is advection of vorticity by rotational flow. You can write in this form. On the right-hand side, there are a bunch of other terms left over, most of which you can neglect, except this term here, which contains the divergence. What the equation is saying, divergence in low latitude will generate rotational flow. Rotational flow are Rossby waves, rotational waves. The point here is that if you have any fluctuations in convective heating, and in particular if that happens at a place where the stratification changes rapidly in the vertical, then you'll generate Rossby waves. And you'll do so preferentially at the equator, not in higher latitudes where you have these additional terms and the balance in the thermodynamic equation is primarily rotational rather than primarily divergent as here. So what's special about the equator in a nutshell is if you have any uniform heating coming from below, and this is what this is supposed to symbolize, there's some uniform heating coming from below. The vertical axis here is pressure, so it's a section through the atmosphere versus latitude. And the contours are temperature, and the colors are this buoyancy frequency. And this is coming from a simulation. Uniform heating from below will lead to divergence near the equator. Divergence will generate Rossby waves, primarily near the equator. And then they'll propagate away from there, meaning they'll bring angular momentum towards the equator, and you can generate super rotation. So even with uniform convection everywhere, you can generate equatorial waves preferentially, transport angular momentum towards the equator, generate super rotation. That's the basic idea for the equatorial jet, and I'll come back to the off-equatorial jets and to the question of why Jupiter and Saturn are so different from Uranus and Neptune in a little bit. So that's how my work here started, basic ideas of dynamics, atmospheric dynamics, and the key challenge then was to make them plausible, to show people this can actually work, and to build a model that incorporates those ideas in a way that's reasonably consistent with the observed balances. So we built a general circulation model for giant planets, which has an ideal gas atmosphere. It's a fairly standard general circulation model for those familiar with the Earth models, with a few exceptions. It has all the right parameters for the planets we are interested in, Jupiter, Saturn, whatever it may be. It has radiative transfers represented in a reasonably simple way. The sun is shining on top of the atmosphere. Sunlight is scattered, absorbed, and the like. And we imposed a uniform heat flux at the lower boundary. The thing that made this project hard in the end, it started with a simple idea, so it made it really hard, is these are big planets, they're rapidly rotating, the turbulence scales are relatively small, you need really high resolution to resolve the eddies we are interested in. You need much higher resolution, in fact, than for a typical Earth climate model. Radiative timescales are very long on those planets. You need to run them for much longer than a typical Earth climate model. So you develop a model, and you don't have the luxury of doing a lot of experiments, tweaking parameters, because each experiment is a couple months of computation. But we can do it, and we did it. The model has maybe one serious artifice that there's no way around it, and there will not be any way around it anytime soon. You'd like to have a lower boundary that goes quite deep into the planet. We can't do it just for numerical reasons. It's too hard. So we have some artificial lower boundary at 3 bar, which is fairly shallow. Now, one thing that is also a consequence of angular momentum conservation, or Newton's second law, is that this is the spin axis. It's just a section through a planet. It's a sketch. Here you have some prograde jet. If you have angular momentum conservation transport into that prograde jet, the angular momentum that's imparted on the mean flow, the mean flow must get rid of it somewhere. It must get rid of it somewhere along a surface of constant angular momentum per unit mass, which is approximately parallel to the spin axis. So somewhere as you go down along the spin axis, there must be some dissipation or some magic transfer back to the turbulent field, but no one has proposed how that would work. So I think there must be some dissipation. These are gas planets. There's not a surface. There's not mechanical drag as you know it. So it must be something else. And there's, I think, one nice idea. It goes back to Junjun's thesis work of how this can work. The idea is that as you go deep into this planet, the electrical conductivity increases just by pressure ionization of hydrogen, for example. Hydrogen sheds its electrons. It becomes essentially metal. It becomes electrically conducting. And where the hydrogen is electrically conducting, any flow in that fluid, in that hydrogen-helium mixture, will sweep along magnetic field lines. There's a magnetic field, as we know, on those planets. So we'll induce an electric current. And that induced electric current will dissipate. Just ohmic dissipation will be there. It's not a superconductor. It's actually not a great conductor at all. But the upshot of all of that is you have some flow that'll interact with the magnetic field where the planet is electrically conducting. It will lead to a generation of heat that is ultimately dissipation. So the net effect is just some drag on the mean flow. I think that's really the only plausible idea right now that we have of how the angular momentum that's imparted to these jets can be dissipated at depth. So there will be, we just assume, there will be some magnetohydrodynamic drag at depth. And that works almost everywhere along the planet, but there's some problems. So this will happen at some depths of the planet. It for sure will happen at about 84% of Jupiter's radius. That number comes from calculating the electric conductivity of hydrogen based on shockwave measurements, how it increases with pressure, and then scaling what dissipation you get. And clearly, the dissipation of the flow can't be larger than a planetary luminosity. That's the one constraint. So that tells you it can't be going further than 84% of Jupiter's radius, but it may not go that far even. So there will be some cutoff radius to which these flows will penetrate with some shear, but they won't go further. But there's this equatorial region. There will be some equatorial region where if you just go down along these cylinders concentric with a spin axis, you won't hit that region where dissipation occurs. You won't hit the region where the atmosphere is electrically conducting. So effectively, the flow here won't experience any noticeable drag, but there will be drag everywhere else. Now, we can't simulate a planet that deep as much as we'd like to, so we have to make this a very shallow planet. 3 bar makes it very shallow. Here we are talking about mega bar pressure rather than a few bar, what we can actually do, so quite off in that regard. But what we do is we just represent this no-drag region at the equator as a region where just represent the whole magnetohydrodynamic drag as a linear drag. It's a vast oversimplification. I think it doesn't matter for the results I want to show. But what does matter is that near the equator is some region whose width we don't quite know. It's the arc cosine of this cutoff radius, where there's essentially no drag, and outside that region there's some drag. So we model all the interesting and intricate magnetohydrodynamics with one linear term in the momentum equation and Newton's second law, and we give it some coefficient r, which is constant outside some cutoff radius and it's zero inside, with some smooth transition in between. And then we simulate things. And these are the results. So the same curves as before, but now the blue lines show some simulation results. And as I said, we didn't have the luxury of tweaking parameters. This was more or less a one-off or a few times off affair to get this right. And particularly the drag parameters, they're very poorly constrained. We don't quite know how strong this magnetohydrodynamic drag should be, yet they affect the flow. So we just picked something that seemed reasonable, but we didn't have a good way of constraining that well. So what do we get? We get prograde flow in Jupiter and Saturn near the equator. You know, the strength, my wife works on lower order dynamical systems. I show her this plot and she says it looks terrible, but keep in mind there are millions and millions of degrees of freedom that are reduced to a few curves here. I think the plot doesn't look terrible in the following sense. So we have prograde flow in Jupiter and Saturn. The velocities are about right. We have retrograde flow in Uranus and Neptune. Here the velocities are outside the error bars, it seems, but some of that, I can give you reasons why it probably is. There are off-control jets in Jupiter and Saturn. Here, for this particular simulation, the scales are a little too large, and the scales will depend on the drag parameter. We have since gotten something closer by varying drag. But what I want to emphasize is simply the qualitative nature of the flow we can reproduce in a way that respects angular momentum conservation and respects the energy balance that has been observed on those planets. And it's really the first model that's energetically consistent of those planets. And to show you that the mechanism I was sketching is actually what is important for generating the superrotation, here's the divergence of the horizontal flow in the upper troposphere of the simulation. And you see these wave structures, in fact, wave packets. These are Rossby wave packets. But the important point is this divergence is confined to the equator. There's convection everywhere coming out of the interior, everywhere at the same strength. But divergence you only get near the equator, again, for fundamental dynamical reasons. There's nothing here, nothing there. So convection will generate these Rossby waves, or will generate Rossby waves through divergence, primarily in low latitudes. If you look at the actual source of Rossby waves, the source of vorticity, of rotational flow, it has this form. It consists of components that represent stretching of vorticity and advection of vorticity. Likewise, you see these wave packets with largest amplitude near the equator. So the point is, although the heat flux is uniform everywhere, comes out at the same strength everywhere, you generate these specific kind of waves preferentially near the equator. They bring momentum towards the equator, and that's why there's superrotation for Jupiter and Saturn and not for Uranus and Neptune. And I'll tell you why not for Uranus and Neptune. But moreover, we have some simulations of vertical structures, so that goes beyond what is observed at the cloud level. This pressure now is a vertical axis, latitude, and the green lines here are the lines at which the flow velocities were shown in the previous plots. These are just the lines at which the observed clouds are believed to occur, depending essentially points where methane condenses and ammonia condenses. And on the right-hand side, this is the solid contours or temperature contours, and the colors are the buoyancy frequency. White means convection leads to essentially neutral stratification. Red means stable stratification. So up here, the atmosphere is heated from above. Convection doesn't make it there, so you end up with a stable stratification. Down here, you have convective heat fluxes from below leading to neutral stratification. Same on Neptune. On Uranus, you have stable stratification almost everywhere because these convective heat fluxes from below are essentially zero. You also see for Uranus and Neptune, it actually depends quite a bit at which level you look at what kind of winds you get. Say if you would look at a level a little bit higher, we would get a much closer fit to observations. That is to say, there's vertical shear. The winds that you see at cloud level, they're not necessarily the same at all levels. For Uranus and Neptune, you're looking at stratospheric winds. For Jupiter and Saturn, the clouds we see are tropospheric clouds. That accounts for part of the difference in the flow structure. Say, Uranus and Neptune down here, they have much smaller scale flow structures than up here in the stratosphere. And that has to do with propagation of waves. Basically, only very big waves ever make it up here and lead to big flow structures. Same is true in Earth's stratosphere. And I think that's part of the difference between Uranus and Neptune on the one hand and Jupiter and Saturn on the other hand. You're just looking at different levels in the atmosphere. We can we can compare what we get in much more detail with the few observations that we have, and they're mostly in the upper atmosphere. So on the right-hand side, this is both from Cassini. The colors and contours here are temperature, and here the contours are temperature, and the colors are, again, buoyancy frequency. And these green lines align corresponding levels. And just an important point is, so in absolute values, the temperatures are quite similar. 100, what do we have there? It's 110 Kelvin or so here. You have this local temperature minimum at the equator, for example, with these ears next to it, just like there. Same on Saturn. It has a very similar structure. The temperature gradients from the equator to pole are quite small. They're probably a little bigger in our simulation than they're observed, but right order of magnitude. So why are Jupiter and Saturn superrotating and Uranus and Neptune not? From everything I've told you, the simple answer is, well, you have strong intrinsic heat fluxes that drive strong convection. Convection leads to generation of Rossby waves near the equator that bring momentum towards the equator. It gives superrotation. I think that in a nutshell, that is the answer. Let's leave it at that. These waves you can actually see in simulations. So this is from a simulation on the left. If you focus on that, this is the zonal, the east-west flow again. Red means prograde, blue means retrograde. So this is all red near the equator. So the flow is towards the right. But you see these wave structures that are superimposed on the flow, they are retrograde relative to the flow. In fact, they're retrograde in an absolute sense here. And that's typical of these Rossby waves to propagate in a retrograde direction. If you look closely, they have tilted phase lines this way, and that's exactly the tilt you need for them to transport angular momentum towards the equator. Lots of other things you can look at, a little vortices swimming in the flow. One thing you can see, there's no great red spot. It's a great sore spot. I think part of the reason is the big vortices form randomly, and this takes a long time for them to form. Maybe if you could run this at higher resolution and much longer, there would be things like the great red spot forming. You can test the ideas I was mentioning. And so if the convection is what gives rise to the superrotation, and we don't need insulation, any sunlight on top, and to get superrotation, and that's in fact true. So if we just make the solar radiation on top uniform, don't give it any gradients, and just have heat fluxes from below, we still get the superrotating equatorial jet, but no off-equatorial jets. So convection alone will drive a superrotating equatorial jet if the drag is low enough, and it's zero here. It's a bit weaker than the jet that you get with the insulation gradient. It's amplified by that. You see there are no temperature gradients here to speak of, a small dip at the equator. Or conversely, if you just set the heat flux coming from below to zero but have insulation gradients, you get retrograde flow at the equator, and you get off-equatorial jets. The off-equatorial jets come about by Birkelinic instability, essentially the same way that we get off-equatorial jets in Earth atmosphere. They live from an instability driven by temperature gradients. Once that's gone, these jets are gone. So there's a long literature on these kind of planetary atmospheres where people just prescribe some random noise in very shallow one-layer models, say, and make that noise in kinetic energy directly or in momentum directly and say, well, it represents convection. This is one example, one counterexample of how this may not work, that logic may not work. Convection does not necessarily generate kinetic energy on large scales. Convection gives you thermal driving, which you don't have in a one-layer model, and only near the equator will that lead to kinetic energy on large scales off the equator. There are no jets. There's nothing really going on of any interest. Okay, there are a bunch of other questions I think we have answers to, and one is, why is Saturn's equatorial jet stronger and wider than Jupiter's? And I, in the interest of time, I can't go through the argument, but I can tell you the result. You make arguments of the kind that Ted and a number of Dick Peltier, others here are familiar with. You make vorticity mixing arguments that give you upper bounds on the strength of the jets, and that upper bound turns out to be half the gravity wave speed. And Saturn ends up having a stronger and wider equatorial jet. The width is proportional to the square root of the gravity wave speed, because the gravity wave speed is larger, and that has to do with fundamental planetary parameters. Exoplanet implications. Many exoplanets have superrotating equatorial jets essentially the same reason, but perhaps slightly differently. If they're tidally locked, you generate Rossby waves in different ways. The same bound, I think, probably should apply for those planets. So if you see strong jets on these exoplanets, I would still think they're not exceeding the gravity wave speed on those planets. They're about half the gravity wave speed. You can maybe even go so far as take this as a measure of the gravity wave speed in a scaling sense. Whereas Uranus subrotating, so based on everything I said, the answer to that is relatively easy. Uranus essentially has no intrinsic heat flux, so the atmosphere is stably stratified all throughout. There's no convective Rossby wave source at the equator. You end up with subrotation everywhere. And that's basically it. But Neptune is curious. So Neptune, the intrinsic heat flux is weak in absolute terms, but it's larger than the insulation, the absorbed insulation. So that heat flux, by comparison with sunlight, is significant, and yet there's subrotation. Why is it? In a nutshell, there's a competition between these baroclinically generated waves and convectively off the equator and convectively generated waves near the equator. The baroclinically generated waves off the equator will tend to suck out momentum from the equator, lead to subrotation. The convectively generated waves near the equator will tend to pump momentum towards the equator, will spin up the flow. And so again, we can test that. We can do one simulation in which we just leave Neptune's insulation as it is, but just crank up the heat flux a little bit up to Saturn's value, so to 2 watts per meter squared rather than 0.4 watts per meter squared. And sure enough, somewhere between 0.4 and 2, there's a transition to superrotation. So if Neptune, or in other words, sometimes earlier in Neptune's history, probably Neptune was superrotating and the heat flux was larger that came out there. Conversely, if you make the insulation on top uniform, leave the heat flux, the 0.4 watts per meter squared as it is, you also get superrotation on Neptune. So there's a competition between these baroclinic eddies and convective Rossby waves. On Neptune, the baroclinic eddies win. And it's actually pretty close to that transition where they wouldn't win. So just the heat fluxes don't need to be a whole lot larger to get superrotation. So this is maybe the aesthetically more pleasing picture to show. It's not as quantitative as these flow profiles I showed you. You have the prograde jets on Jupiter and Saturn, retrograde jets on Uranus and Neptune, one jet in each hemisphere for Uranus and Neptune away from the equator, and several for Uranus and Neptune. And part of that, I didn't dwell on it for Uranus and Neptune, that you only have one jet is you have large scales because you're looking high up in the atmosphere. We also get vortices. This is one example of a coherent vortex at the pole. It's embedded in this polar vortex. And this polar vortex in itself has interesting structures, Jupiter and Saturn simulations, polar views. There are these observations of a hexagonal polar vortex on Saturn. Sometimes people call it a hexagonal hurricane, although it has really nothing to do with a hurricane. You see similar polygonal, hexagonal, or maybe octagonal patterns in the vortices here as well, with coherent vortices embedded. It's just, again, these Rossby waves, same waves riding on the rim of the vortex as they do in Earth's stratosphere. And this hexagon is probably just a wave number 6 Rossby wave riding on that vortex. We do have answers to the question of why there are, or what controls the number of jets that you see in each one of those planets. And the answer is, it comes down to the scale of the waves that are generated again, and it comes down to linear scales, perhaps somewhat surprisingly. And in brief, the vertical axis here is the zonal wave number, so it's a measure of the inverse of the energy-containing wave length scale, and this is a function of latitude. And the orange line is that wave number, so it is relatively large, small wave number at the equator, relatively larger wave number, smaller scale off the equator. And these wave numbers are fit fairly well by the scales of linear waves. This is an equatorial Rossby wave scale right here, the dashed line, which is just depends on gravity wave speed. And this is the off-equatorial Rossby wavelength right here, also just depends on gravity wave speed and rotation of the planet. And there's a turbulent length scale that some of you are familiar with that basically coincides with that linear wave scale. The implication for those of you working in condensed matter theory, you like to have a coarse-grained description of the whole thing here, and I'm only sketching some of the qualitative scaling results. And I think these results show somewhat more generally we don't have that coarse-grained description, a statistical mechanics description of this, and it's an unequilibrium statistical mechanics system, it's hard. But we have a pretty good chance of getting it because these linear and nonlinear wavelength scales, they coincide. What this means is that the If you focus on a lower plot only, this is an energy transfer in wave number space. And what it shows is you have this total energy transfer from one wavelength to another. It's a solid line. And most of that comes about by transfers from eddies from one wave to the mean flow. So most of it comes about by the by the loop level interaction, if you like. It's just the interaction between one wave and the mean flow. And the interaction between eddies themselves, the higher order terms in some expansion of the interaction in if you think about a Feynman diagram expansion of the interaction, these would be higher order terms. This is a loop level term. They're much, much smaller, and which is to say that this problem is relatively weakly nonlinear, at least in these simulations, and all the evidence from observations is that, that's generally true. So weakly nonlinear theories have a pretty good chance of being successful. And beyond that, we can say something about spectrum, the energy containing scales. That I think is something that's testable based on the observations we already have. That I hope someone will go through and compute the spectra from the observations. Final word on Juno. As Juno is approaching Jupiter, I showed you results from simulations, but the underlying principles are far more fundamental than the details of simulation output that depends on details of drag and the like. And the principles I only sketched. I didn't go through it in great detail. But the key is that we have constraints from the angular momentum balance that say that these winds have to basically penetrate downward along angular momentum surfaces. It's something that Ted worked on in the Earth context. It's known as downward control in Earth atmosphere. And we must have temperature gradients that are in thermal wind balance, in some geostrophic and hydrostatic balance with the shear in those zonal winds. And we know that at some point there must be dissipation acting on these zonal winds. So we don't quite know where at 0.84 radii or 0.97 is sort of the upper bound we have calculated for that radius, but somewhere in between there will be dissipation acting. But from that information alone and the equation of state, we can now calculate without any model, this is just really analytical solutions translated into graphics, and using the observed upper viscous flow, we can calculate what the flow structure at depth is, which is the left plot here. From that, you can just differentiate, you get the shear, and that has to be in balance with the gradient perpendicular to the spin axis of the entropy. S is the specific entropy. When you use the equation of state, you can get a temperature gradient from the entropy gradient, and from that, the density structure. We have a complete prediction of the flow, density, and temperature structure, at least in the shell up to 0.84 or something like the Jupiter radii. Unfortunately, we can't say a whole lot near the equator. We left that blank. But at least in that area, we can make predictions. We can calculate the gravity signature. We can calculate the microwave signature, and we have done that, that Juno would measure based on these dynamical constraints alone. And they're measurable. The good news is all of that is above the detection levels of this Juno spacecraft. So let me just summarize briefly a few key features. And I think all of them have general implications, not just for all our solar system, but for other giant planets in general. The off-equatorial jets, by and large, are baroclinically generated. Insulation gradients are the key. You need temperature gradients driven by insulation gradients making the waves that make these jets. This heat flux coming from the interior, it destabilizes the deeper atmosphere. It increases the baroclinicity, the effectiveness of these baroclinic waves that gives rise to interactions between the off-equatorial waves and the convection. But more importantly, the internal heat flux generates convection. It leads to the generation of equatorial Rossby waves, leads to momentum flux towards the equator, can lead to superrotation if competing effects are weak enough, baroclinic eddies are weak enough, drag is weak enough. I think the key to close the momentum and energy budget is some dissipation at depth. I really don't see any way to avoid that. And the only plausible dissipation mechanism we have is coupling to the magnetic field dissipation of the electric current at depth. There might be details one might argue how exactly that works. It's not necessarily local. It's potentially somewhat complicated, and we just made this a linear drag that's guaranteed to be too simple, but that's not a crucial part for the arguments I want to make. The turbulence doesn't need to be strong, and it's strong in a physical sense. There's just the interaction parameter may be weak, and that gives you some hope that without running expensive models on the biggest computers we have, you can get a handle on what these flows are at some point, and we are not there yet. And we have some predictions for Juno that Well, at least we were just finishing up that paper. At least it puts something on the line. We're happy to be proven wrong. We'll have learned something either way, whether it's right or wrong. So, thank you.